on ABC Radio National, it's time for Counterpoint, an hour of opinion and discussion with Paul Comrie-Thompson and Michael Duffy.
Hello and welcome to Counterpoint. Today we're joined by Bob Carter. Now, Bob's been one of the few Australian scientists prepared to publicly question the prevailing view that climate change is dangerous and primarily caused by human beings. He joins us in a moment to discuss his new book, Climate, the Counter-Consensus.
What do you think about India? When comparing India with China, John Lee has this to say. Bollywood movies and tandoori might be popular the world over, but it is India's robust democracy and attractive values that give it a truly great soft power potential. But for the moment, that potential is unrealised. Later in the program, John argues that India has to do a lot more to win over its sceptics and position itself to be a future leader in its region.
And then we turn, as we must, to the World Cup. Millions, if not billions, of people have been enthralled in recent weeks. Is it possible for anyone not to like soccer? Well, if it is, it's the job of Counterpoint to find them, and some listeners at least will be delighted to learn that we have. University of Chicago economist Alan Sanderson has tried to understand the attraction of soccer, but like many of his fellow Yanks, he just doesn't get it.
Then a look at the thinking behind Australia's bid to host the World Cup in 2022, or 2028, or whenever it might be. Most people seem to assume that what is good for a world sporting event is good for the host country. But Andrew Zimbalist warns, think before you bid. He argues that the costs of preparing, securing, and then accommodating a major sporting event, like the Olympics or a World Cup, often outweigh the benefits.
But first to climate. Bob Carter is adjunct professorial research fellow at James Cook University, and his field is paleoclimatology. Now, for years, Professor Carter has been critical of the global warming doomsday scenario. Yes, he says the temperatures have risen over the last century, but climate always changes. And, he argues further, human impact has been negligible. We talked recently about his new book, Climate, the Counter-Consensus. I asked him to explain why he sees himself as an agnostic on climate matters rather than a sceptic.
There are two extreme views on the issue. One is that human-caused global warming is a huge danger, and the other one is that climate change isn't a problem at all. Now, the great majority of scientists sit in the middle, and they're agnostic on it. They want to see where the balance of the evidence lies. So that's what I do. I assess evidence, and I assess evidence in order to test hypotheses.
Let's talk a bit about your book, Climate, the Counter-Consensus. Last year, Ian Plimer wrote a book, Heaven and Earth, which I think sold very well and certainly got an enormous amount of publicity in Australia and England. What are you hoping to add with this book to the debate?
Well, it's not about climate change so much, Michael. This is about climate risk. And my take on this is that certainly government needs a policy on climate risk. And those risks include things like cyclones and the dreadful bushfires and floods we had last year in Australia. Remember, 173 people, I think, killed in the Victorian bushfires. These are non-trivial, natural risks that relate to climate. Of course, government should have a policy that addresses them better, because the various inquiries we always have after one of these climatic tragedies tells us we weren't as well prepared as we should have been. So no problem with that. Most scientists would take the same line. We need better policies to manage climate risk. One of the climate risks, it happens to be one of the lesser ones, so far as we can tell, is that we might be having an effect on the global climate and it might be warming. Now, should that be the case, and should we sometime in the future be able to measure that human impact, and I stress, we can't do it yet, but if it was to manifest itself in the future, and we've prepared our climate risk policy based on the analysis of natural climate hazard, then of course we are pre-prepared for any additional risk that comes from human effects on climate. So it's a no-brainer, really. And my whole book is around developing up to Chapter 11, which terms what I've just described to you, Plan B. We need a Plan B. The time has come to stop butting heads, he says, she says, about whether global warming's happened in the last 10, 15, 20 years or whatever. The time has come to develop a new, constructive, forward-looking Plan B to prepare for and adapt to, as they happen, all climate events and risks, including natural hazards and including hypothetical human-caused hazard should it emerge.
Bob, let's talk a bit about carbon dioxide. Most people think that the increase of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere slows down the rate at which we lose heat and contributes to global warming. Can you just tell us a bit about that? I mean, what's your view on that mechanism?
It's not important what my view is or what any scientist's view is. It's a matter of what the facts tell us. And the facts tell us that carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. No scientist doubts that. It's also a mild greenhouse gas in the present levels that it's at in the atmosphere. And the reason for this is as you increase the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the temperature goes up commensurately, but not in a linear fashion. And as you put more carbon dioxide in, for every extra bang of carbon dioxide you put in, you get less of a buck increase in the temperature. It's what scientists call a logarithmic curve. And we're well up on the logarithmic curve, such that you have to put a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere to get a measurable temperature increase. It appears from the records that the amount of carbon dioxide we've put in the last 50 years has not produced a temperature increase that's large enough to distinguish from natural variation. That's not to say it hasn't had an effect. It's just that the effect is so small, we cannot yet isolate and measure it.
And how do you see the future? I mean, what do you think is likely to happen in the future if we keep increasing the amount of carbon dioxide we do put in the atmosphere?
Well, one thing that's going to happen, especially if we go into a global cooling, is that extra carbon dioxide will do what the extra carbon dioxide in the 20th century has done, and that's help plants grow and help green the planet. Now, people seem to be very focused on the dangers of global warming. The dangers of global cooling to the world's food supply are much greater and very real. If the present solar situation, that's a very quiet sun, continues, as some solar physicists say it will, then we could be looking at half a degree or a degree of cooling in the next 20, 30 years. That will have dramatic effects on the productivity of the great grain-growing belts in the Northern Hemisphere. A little bit of extra carbon dioxide in the atmosphere not only causes a little bit, as yet unmeasurable, warming to combat that cooling, but it also provides fertilisation to make plants grow more efficiently, which is a great boost.
Can I just ask you, on a personal note, you have been talking about this for a long time now. You've become a very public figure, not just in Australia. You've given evidence to parliamentary committees. You've given many talks and written many articles. And I think in the public arena, most of the scientists who have stuck their head up have probably been on the other side of the debate. How do you feel about that now, having seen the course of the debate over a decade or so? What does it make you think about science and public discussion of science?
Well, we're in trouble, and it's not just Australia that's in trouble, it's most Western nations. And the reason we're in trouble is that governments, and this didn't start yesterday, this has been going on for 20, 30 years, started to say, if we're going to spend taxpayers' money to support researchers in government departments or universities, then those researchers had better do something useful, in inverted commas. Now, who decides what is useful? And the answer is, the politicians do. If there's one thing we know about the history of science, it is that nobody knows in advance, even the politicians, where the breakthroughs are going to come. The appropriate way to fund scientific research, and this is a deeply unfashionable view, is to fund scientists to investigate what they are expert in and what they are interested in. The moment you say, here's a problem, here's a funding tree on which I'm going to hang in Australia, let's say $150 million of research funding, called global warming, you will find that every scientist in the country, because they're quite creative, intelligent individuals, will devise applications for that money that take for granted the problem. In other words, that say they're going to investigate global warming. So having these priority funding mechanisms drives scientists into very narrow lines of research which are specified basically by political or public fashion. That is devastating for science.
How's it made you feel personally? Has it been a lonely road at times that you've taken?
No, because the majority of scientists that I mix with are independent. They do not work for the IPCC, and contrary to received public wisdom, the great majority of independent scientists think that this climate thing is overblown. Not to say that, I should say the global warming thing is overblown. not to say there isn't a genuine climate risk. There is, and most sensible scientists are worried we should prepare for that risk better. But the risk is dominantly natural climate change. So it's not lonely at all. There's thousands of scientists around the world who understand the situation and who are beavering away doing good research, but they're not getting very much money from the tree marked global warming.
So for years we've heard that there's a scientific consensus that the science is settled. You disagree with that?
Oh, it's completely untrue. There's not a shred of evidence for there being consensus. There's just some very loud voices, some very expert marketing and propaganda campaigns spearheaded basically by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and its supporters. They have an extreme view and they've successfully managed to impose that view on most Western political sects.
Are you a bit more optimistic now, maybe, about the future of this issue than you would have been 2 years ago?
Yes, because there's been a huge swing in public opinion. And it's very clear, not only in Australia, but in the UK and elsewhere, that the majority of the public smell a rat. And they are not going to support the sort of emissions trading legislation that Kevin Rudd was trying to implement here. It's quite unclear how this will play out over the short to medium term, but it is very clear the public have changed their view and they're not going to tolerate taxation, which involves a great deal of expenditure, and the money comes from them, for no environmental gain. The estimate is that if we had a $20 to $30 carbon dioxide tax, which was the level that the Labor government was thinking of having, the average annual cost to a family of four in Australia is of the order of $3,000. The return to the environment is a theoretical prevention of warming of less than 1/1000th of a degree. That is an absurd cost-benefit relationship, and no taxpayer for a millisecond is going to support it.
Professor Bob Carter is from James Cook University, and his book's called Climate, the Counter-Consensus. That's published by Stacey International in the UK.
Still to come on Counterpoint today, everyone seems to want one, but are those mega sporting events really worth hosting? We also hear from an American sports fan who tells us he's tried, but he really doesn't get soccer. And coming up next, soft power and India.